as you want, but they will at some point start yelling. Worse than that, if you ignore them long enough, they will go silent. And that's the real tragedy. What's changing everything for me is a new understanding that we get to decide how we want to live. We get to shape our days and our weeks, and if we don't, they'll get shaped by the wide catch-all of normal and typical. And who wants that? You can live on a farm or out of a backpack. You can work from your kitchen or in a high-rise. You can worship in your living room or in a cathedral. Isn't that beautiful and exciting and so full of freedom? You can wear slippers or heels, eat steak or kale, read poetry or spreadsheets, fall asleep to the hum of the city or out under the stars. You get to make your life. In fact, you have to. And not only can you make it, you can remake it. So many of the people I admire most have lived several lives. My favorite college professor spent a couple decades in a beach town and now lives a positively city life. My friends Tish and Kyle and their three kids just traveled around the world for a year. Blaine, an actor and maker who's lived like a gypsy for years, just bought a house in our neighborhood with his wife Margaret and their darling girls Ruby and Eloise. And this longtime wanderer is growing herbs and lettuces, driving down roots, literally and otherwise. We get to decide, which is both so freeing and such a beautiful responsibility. You can be a vegan, you can be a priest, you can homeschool, you can train for a triathlon, you can live in a city, you can read the classics, you can buy all your clothes from a vintage shop, you can buy a Vespa, you can learn to speak Farsi or Italian. This life you're building is entirely your creation, fashioned out of your dreams and fears. What do you want? What do you love? What ways of living have you simply acquiesced to because someone told you to, because it seems smart or practical or easy? Are those the best words to describe how you want to live? If I'm honest, I let words like responsible and capable govern many of my years. And what good are they? Words that I'm choosing in this season? Passion, connection, meaning, love, grace, spirit. The world will tell you how to live if you let it. Don't let it. Take up your space, raise your voice, sing your song. This is your chance to make or remake a life that thrills you. This is what I see. The men I know have very few questions about who they are, what they want, what they're offering to the world, what they're not. Frankly, I think that certainty holds its own challenges, but for the most part is a gift. Most women I know, myself certainly included, have struggled to find our own footing and calling and voice. I'm so very thankful for the solid ground that seems to multiply a couple square inches under my feet with each passing year. I'm an extrovert through and through and a deeply loyal person. Because of those two qualities, I've made most of my biggest decisions by committee, choosing to believe that the people I love most will advise me well and that their wisdom will prevail. That has been immensely helpful for so many decisions. And yet, this last round of decisions have been made in silence and solitude, and that's been necessary and healing and challenging. I've wanted the committee, and at the same time, I've sensed that there are some seasons in which the only way through is alone, a solitary path of listening and learning. This is uncomfortable for me, and I've yearned to gather around my people at every point for familiarity and safety. There are, though, certain passages you have to walk alone. When you arrive on the other side, the people you love most will be there to meet you, certainly, to wrap their arms around you and walk closely with you once again. But it's only when we're truly alone that we can listen to our lives and God's voice speaking out from the silence. These last months have required more silence than any other season in my life. I've both craved it and avoided it in equal turns, and finally realized that the craving is something to listen to, something to obey. These days, I'm pursuing regular intervals of silence and solitude. It's almost like training wheels or like a cast. I'm so unfamiliar with listening deeply to my own life and desires that I can only do it in the context and confines of silence. I lose track of my own voice in a crowd very easily. In seasons of deep transformation, silence will be your greatest guide. Even if it's scary, especially if it's scary, let silence be your anchor, your sacred space, your dwelling place. It's where you will become used to your own voice, your agency, your authority. It's where you will nurture that fledgling sense of authority, like a newborn deer on spindly, fragile legs. Silence will become the incubator for your newfound spirit, keeping it safe, growing it steadily. For the first time in my life, it's when I'm alone and quiet that I feel my strength. I need more and more of it than I ever have, like a vitamin, like a safe house. Legacy. A friend asked me to help with a project. He had written a wonderful curriculum, helping people sort through their desires and dreams for their lives, and he needed, essentially, an on-camera guinea pig. I'd come to his house, and a film crew would shoot us sitting at his kitchen table, working through the curriculum together. I asked how I could prep for it. Nothing, he said. Don't read a thing. Don't plan a thing. Let's make it really fresh and present and real. And that we did. We began in the morning, goals, memories, the plot points of my childhood and adolescent years. We plugged along, sharing stories, laughing between takes. And then toward the end, the conversation turned to legacy, the end of life, regret. And with the cameras rolling and the room full of talented, kind people I'd never met, I looked up at my friend and began to cry. I don't want to miss the actual fabric of the interior of my life and the beautiful children growing up right this second in my own home because I'm working to please people somewhere out there. I'm afraid I'm missing it. I'm afraid I'm doing it wrong, and I want to know that I can change. Their crew held their breath. Fat, hot tears fell onto my notebook, smearing the black ink. My friend paused before he spoke, put a brotherly hand on my shoulder. When I looked back up at him, he said, "You can get this right. It's not too late. You can start again right now." When we got to the end of that segment, I laughed to break the tension. I apologized to the crew. "Oh my gosh, you guys, I'm so sorry. I'll pull it together." They laughed, shook off my apology, regrouped for the next shot. As ever, the invitations to remake your life come from every corner if you're looking for them. In someone else's city, in someone else's home, sitting at someone else's kitchen table, I knew with all certainty that what I longed for was my own table, my own home, my city, my people. This wasn't the first invitation, certainly. I remember another months earlier. I was at a gathering of women, mostly writers and speakers, many I knew, some I was meeting for the first time. One of the things that they asked us to do, create video content for some upcoming projects. Usually when this happens, you show up at the assigned room at the assigned time and a nice person introduces himself. He clips on your mic, explains the goal, and then you start the interview. This time, though, there was no one in the room, just written instructions, a chair, and a camera aimed at the chair. The instructions explained that all you had to do was sit, start recording via remote control, and answer any of the questions printed on the card sitting on the chair. Easy enough. And then I picked a card that said something about my legacy. That word again. I knew what they were looking for. They wanted me to articulate my vocation, my passion, my message. I had done it 1,000 times. But something about being away again, something about the silence of that room, the tears once again surprised me. The legacy I care most about is the one I'm creating with the people who know me best. My children, my husband, my best friends. And I have to make a change. I wish I could tell you that everything changed in an instant after that first video shoot. Or that everything really, really did change after the second. But I've always been a stubborn one. Slow to change. Ignoring whispers until the screaming starts. That idea, though, of the legacy I'm leaving is rattling around in my brain and my heart. I've preferred to believe that I can be all things to all people, but when I'm honest about my life, in the past couple years, I've been better from a distance than I have been in my own home. I've given more to strangers and publishers and people who stand in line after events than I have to my neighbors, my friends. I come home weary and self-protective, pulled into a shell of exhaustion and depleted emotions. This is, to be clear, not the legacy I want to leave. It's all right here. Oh, the fear I've known, that I might reap the praise of strangers and end up on my own. All I've sung was a song. Maybe I was wrong. Indigo Girls, Language, or The Kiss. I had a conversation with a fascinating man on a ferry. He was a friend of a friend, and somehow the circle of conversation we'd both been a part of ended, and it left just the two of us. He told me a story that started with love and creativity and good intentions. He told me about how passionate he was about traveling and speaking, how much he loved spreading the message of his work to people all over the world, and how the heart of it is love, loving people wherever he met them, giving them the best of his energy and his attentiveness. It sounded amazing. And then he told me the next part of the story, which is that he became so deeply skilled at making people feel loved in an instant. And along the way, he lost the ability to demonstrate actual, real love to the woman and the children who were waiting at home. Making someone feel loved in an instant is so much easier than showing someone your love over and over, day in and day out. He had become a master at quick, intense, emotional connection. And with each experience of it, he found himself less able to connect in the daily, trudging, one after the other kinds of ways. He is alone now, not living with the woman who was his wife, not living with his children. That quick love cost him enduring love, and it wasn't worth it. This is a common story, isn't it? The pastor loves to solve other people's problems, but doesn't come home with enough emotional energy in the tank for his family's everyday problems. The writer becomes addicted to the IV drip of blog comments and likes, while her family longs for her to close the laptop and look them in the eye. It's easy to be more charming in a sales meeting than at witching hour, and it's nice to feel competent at something when family life feels difficult at best. By nice, I mean addictive. So many of us have taken those steps, if we're honest, because we don't know how to fix the problems we've created, because we never learned the set of skills we needed to navigate such difficult intimacy. We dive into information or work or bicycling or whatever, because it feels good to be good at something, to master something, to control something when marriage and intimacy often feel profoundly out of our control. And so little by little, we tiptoe away. And before we know it, there's a cavern between us, easily filled by someone simpler, better suited to us, someone honestly who hasn't had to put up with us for quite so long, someone who still laughs at our jokes. Part of the reason I was so interested in my conversation with that man on the ferry boat was because it sounded so familiar to me, like the story I'd heard from so many dear friends in the last couple years. I don't know if it's a mid-30s thing or a married more than a dozen years thing, but it's happening all around us. And when you look at the story in reverse, you see 1,000 little choices that yielded the wreckage. One or the other retreated, for whatever reason, hurt or fear or any number of things, to self-protect or to hide. And then the distance is created. The distance seems to almost always create space for another person. And then there's a whole new level of pain and violation. But when you look back at the months and years before the third person, it's first a story about distance. And when things are hard and painful and barbed at home, what a lovely thing it is to be loved at your work, right? What a lovely and dangerous thing. What an easy escape into people who think you're great and work that makes you feel valuable. I can master my laptop in a way I cannot master parenting. I can control my publishing schedule and my deadlines in a way I cannot control our marriage. This is why the ferryboat conversation got to me, because there was a moment several months ago when Aaron was frustrated with me about something. The kids were wild and grumpy, and these are the words I heard coming out of my own mouth. Everybody likes me better than you three do. That's what you call a wake-up call. That's a change-your-life, start-right-now moment, and so we did, because I was on the path that man on the ferry was on. It's easy to be liked by strangers. It's very hard to be loved and connected to the people in your home when you're always bringing them your most exhausted self and resenting the fact that the scraps you're giving them aren't cutting it. And many of us are too exhausted from the work we love to get down on the floor with our toddlers or stay in the second hour of a difficult conversation with our spouses. It seems to me that one of the great hazards is quick love, which is actually charm. We get used to smiling, hugging, bantering, practicing good eye contact, and it's easier than the true, slow, awkward, painful connection with someone who sees all the worst parts of you. Your act is easy. Being with you, deeply with, is difficult. But it is better to be loved than admired. It's better to be truly known and seen and taken care of by a small tribe than adored by strangers who think they know you in a meaningful way. We know that's true. But many of us, functionally, have gotten that math wrong in one season or another. And many of us were utterly unprepared for the true intimacy required for deep, vulnerable marriage. I'm fine with partnership and sharing space. I'm a cuddler and a talker. But when it comes to truly deep connection, I'm just now building a toolbox with those skills. I feel like I'm catching up to it barely. Quick charm will always be easier for me than deep connection. People out there are easier than the ones in here. But quick charm is like sugar. It rots us. It winds us up and leaves us jonesing, but it doesn't feed us. Only love feeds us. And love happens over years. Repetitive motions. Staying, staying, staying. Showing up again. Coming clean again. Being seen again. That's how love is built. And if you can wean yourself off the drug of quick charm, off the drug of being good at something, losing yourself in something, the drug of work or money or information or marathon training, whatever it is that you do to avoid the scary intimacy required for a rich home life, that's when love can begin but only then. It's all in here, not out there. The man in the tuxedo for the Guinaud family. The phone call came on a Tuesday afternoon, bright sun slanting in the window. I was folding laundry on the bed and the sunlight lit up the silvery blankets and the white duvet, and I smoothed the little piles of Mac's jeans and Henry's shirts. If you'd told me 5 years ago, 5 months ago even, that an opportunity like this would come to me, I wouldn't have believed it. I was so happy on the phone. I almost said yes, but just basically as a formality, I said I needed to talk to my husband and my agent. I hung up the phone, and where I expected a clean burst of excitement and adrenaline, instead I felt worried. I felt fearful and nervous and like I wanted to hide. I walked around the house for a few minutes trying to untangle my thoughts. I grabbed a pen and paper, started scribbling. For most of my life, I've been skating past negative feelings, staying busy, putting a positive spin on them. I've been ignoring my body's responses. Maybe I need a coffee, a breath of fresh air. Staying in it, sitting in it, noticing those subtle messages that our bodies speak to us if we listen. These have not been my experience. I've been outrunning my feelings for decades, only very recently beginning to sit with, sit still, dwell. But I did it on a sunny Tuesday afternoon, and what I noticed as I sat in that space was fear and anxiety. What should have delighted me instead made me afraid. And I know that should is one of my warning signs, that frequently I pay more attention to how I should feel about something than how I actually do feel about it. I talked to Aaron about it when he got home, and he, who cheers me on, who celebrates with me, crumpled, overwhelmed by the prospect of what this opportunity would cost our family. I thought it was going to change, he said. I thought the crazy was over. It wasn't a good time to talk about it, but that's part of the problem. When you've created a life for yourself that doesn't leave space for talking about life-changing decisions, you're doing it wrong. And we had been doing it wrong for a long time. He'd had an overwhelming day, and we had a video shoot at our house the next day, making me jumpy and perfectionistic about keeping the house clean, making Aaron in turn cranky and short with everyone. I asked for more time, and in the next 3 days, I went back and forth a dozen times. Of course I can. If I can, then I have to. They need me. They need me to be responsible and tough. I should. Warning, warning, warning. The words tough, responsible, and should have never led me to life in wholeness. The video shoot came and went, then a road trip and an out-of-town meeting came and went, and I arrived back in town just in time for small group. Blaine and Margaret had just moved into our neighborhood, and once our boys were settled in with their favorite sitter, Aaron and I walked over. Boots crunching the snow and ice, holding hands, our breath making clouds in the light of the streetlights. Margaret made my favorite pork ragu of her pappardelle, and after dinner we sat in their new living room. I wanted their advice. I knew what I wanted, and I knew what I'd always been doing, what I'd been trained to do. I knew what the right thing was ideologically, but I'm a good soldier, and I wanted this team to know that. And then Margaret told us about a very dear family friend dying of cancer. This is the very end, a month maybe. Earlier that week, he asked Blaine to come over and record a video. When Blaine arrived, he was shocked to see that Robert was in a tuxedo. The video he wanted Blaine to capture was his toasts for his kids' weddings. Because he won't be there for his kids' weddings. He had written his toasts word for word, and he spoke those words right into the camera, voice garbled by his sickness. He was, Margaret told us, using every remaining second, leaving nothing unsaid. Giving love and words and stories and wisdom, spending the last moments he has with great intention. They turned to me. You said you needed advice, they asked. No, I said. I did, but now I know. I don't know this man, the one who stood in his tuxedo, speaking to his children at some future wedding day. And his story is his, and it's valuable on its own terms, nothing to do with me. And yet I do believe that if you're asking for help, for guidance, you'll receive it, and it might come in a different way than you expect. I needed to know who should get the best of my energy, my boys, or a company that asked me to speak for them. I needed to know what matters, and the image of that man in his tuxedo was all I needed. You will always regret something. You will always disappoint someone, but it isn't going to be my husband and our boys. It has been sometimes, but I'm learning, and I'm making things right. And so this morning I sent the email, afraid I'd be seen as weak, or irresponsible, afraid that by saying no to this opportunity, I'd be pulling the ripcord on a career I'd spent a decade building, praying for opportunities like this one. At the same time, though, I knew that this was a clear shot at a new future, that saying yes to this would be continuing a way of living, a set of patterns that I've been trying to leave behind for a long time. It became enormous in my mind. Can I change or can't I? Do I mean all the things I've been saying about worth and rest and what matters most? Or don't I? I wrote the email, praying as I wrote, releasing control. I felt more peace after I sent it than I had all week. No to this could very well mean no to another opportunity I really wanted, but I had to lay them both down because I needed to leave this old way of living, jamming things onto the calendar last minute, clearing away space to write and connect with my family, only to fill it up at the last minute with one more event, one more trip, one more conversation where I couldn't figure out how to say no, and so I said yes, crammed full of fear and building resentment. And then a few hours later, the response came. We understand. We affirm your decision, and we still want to invite you into this other project when it's right for you, in the way that's right for you. My no was heard, and it was valued. I was so close to doing something I didn't want to do because I was afraid. I was so close to doing the wrong thing for my husband and my boys. But I kept thinking of the man in the tuxedo who knows now, because the end is coming, what matters more than anything. The no I said today is making space for yes. Something I haven't had space for in a long time. In recent years, I started to sense that I was being run by something other than my own voice and calling, something other than God's vision for my life. And I talked and talked about it, but unfortunately mostly kept doing things the same way, out of habit and fear and that crazy sense that just one more would be okay. Now just one more. Now just for him or for her, for an old friend, to help someone out. But sometimes you need to say, not one more time. I won't get this wrong again. Today was that day for me. My kids won't know the difference. Mac won't even remember. But I'll know. I'll know when I tuck them in at night, when I make them jelly toast in the morning, that I could have been somewhere else. And a man in a tuxedo, a man I've never met, showed me a better way. The spring of the basketball hoop. This spring is the spring of the basketball hoop. Aaron and I had talked about it a little bit. In the loose conversation we have on a walk or while the boys are tearing around the park, we should get a basketball hoop. Fell into the same idle, well-intentioned chatter as we should do something about the landscaping and we should go camping. And then one day, when one of our boys was having a hard day, another hard day after a couple hard weeks, anxiety and fear, sleeplessness, he and I were in the house. And when we looked out the front window, we saw Aaron dragging a basketball hoop down the sidewalk. One of our neighbors had dragged it to the curb and stuck a free sign on it, and on his way home from work, Aaron grabbed it. We ran outside, delighted, confused. Did you just steal a basketball hoop? Our son was very concerned. Aaron assured him that it was free for the taking. We cleaned it up and put up a smaller size one, too, for littler kids. And we are just absolutely in love with this beat-up, hand-me-down basketball hoop and its shorter neighbor hoop. On hard mornings, it helps our son's anxious feelings if we make sure we're all ready about 20 minutes before the bus comes, and we all go outside together. I shuffle out in my slippers and bedhead, bringing out coffee for Aaron and me. The kids shoot around, and the neighbor kids wander over. By the time the bus comes, the nerves have been shaken off, and our boy runs to the corner, yelping and laughing with the rest of the kids. We play before school and after, and it's contagious, it seems. You can't walk by without shooting, and then if you miss, you can't help but try a few more times. We had friends over for dinner last night, and one friend had just finished preaching at church. He was still in his navy blazer, but he jumped right in and took a few shots nonetheless. My brother and dad shoot around with us when they stop over on Wednesday nights and Sunday mornings. One night, our boys were shooting around, and Aaron sunk a great shot. I took a picture of him while he shot, and he posted it on Instagram, issuing a challenge to his best friend Steve, one of the best basketball players we know, and one of the most competitive people we know. We laughed about it, and then I went in to start dinner, slicing tomatoes and onions and jalapenos, scooping avocados out of their leathery shells for guacamole. I heard cheering in the driveway. Apparently, Steve saw the post at his house, jumped in the car, and was running up our driveway while the kids cheered and yelled, "Challenge! Challenge!" It would offend Aaron terribly if I called it an upset, but that's what it was. Aaron beat Steve quite soundly, and the kids were delighted about the whole thing. We went in and had tacos and quesadillas, and the boys kept saying, "Remember when Daddy beat Uncle Steve?" We had a party recently, lots of kids and adults, and while I'd planned for us to eat around the dining room table and at the kitchen counter, the group planted itself in the driveway because of the boys, because of the basketball hoop. We pulled the grill around from the back patio and the fire pit too. We roasted marshmallows in the driveway, watched the stars come out, shot baskets till it was too dark to see a thing. It feels right more and more often to let the boys' desires define our decisions, not in every way, but in some. The hours we've spent in the driveway this spring are some of the sweetest we've spent together. Aaron and I aren't homebodies, not at all, not routine people, even a little. We love to travel, love the changes of scenery and adventure, but our boys are teaching us about home, about patterns, about the most meaningful ways to spend our time. Our home is becoming more an anchor and less a place to land for a hot minute between work trips. Our driveway, of all places, is becoming the place where our life unfolds, and I'm loving the change. When brave looks boring. My brother Todd and I live on the same street. We share a lawnmower, and he stops over for a drink and to say hi to the boys a couple times a week after work. One night, Aaron was working and the boys were playing, and Todd and I had a rare quiet moment, sitting alone together in the kitchen. Something had gotten tangled up between Aaron and me that week. I can't even remember what it was, but I made some comment to my brother about the joys of matrimony. He's single and profoundly independent. I know our messy, loud kid house makes him half crazy. But that night he said, "I think you and Aaron are really brave. Look what you've done. Look what you've built. You've built a marriage, a home, a family. You've stayed with it even when it was hard. You're patient with the kids even when that's hard. I think that's brave." Todd's one of those people who's done like a million exciting things, among them sailing around the world. He told me that people used to always tell him, "You're so brave." He looked at me evenly while he spoke. Sailing around the world isn't necessarily brave. Leaving real life for 2 years isn't necessarily brave. What you're doing, what you're building, I think that's brave. His words stayed with me after he left, after I tucked the boys in, after I walked through our little house, turning off lights, picking up toys, closing drapes. He was right, I realized. Brave doesn't always involve grand gestures. Sometimes brave looks more like staying when you want to leave, telling the truth when all you want to do is change the subject. Sometimes obedience means climbing a mountain. Sometimes obedience means staying home. Sometimes brave looks like building something big and shiny. Sometimes it means dismantling a machine that threatened to overshadow much more important things. We're addicted to big and sweeping and photo-ready, crossing oceans, changing it all, starting new things, dreams and visions and challenges, marathons and flights and ascending tall peaks. But the rush to scramble up onto platforms, to cross oceans, to be heard and seen and known, sometimes comes at a cost. And sometimes the most beautiful things we do are invisible, unsexy. We love broad strokes, cross-country moves, Kickstarter campaigns. But brave these days is a lot quieter, at least for me. Brave is staying put when I'm addicted to rushing, forgiving myself when I want that familiar frisson of shame that I've become so used to using as a motivator. Brave is listening instead of talking. Brave is articulating my feelings, especially when the feelings are sad or scared or fragile, instead of confident or happy or light. Brave is walking away from the strike while the iron's hot mentality that pervades our culture. Brave is being intentional about taking your marriage from fine to can't live without you. Because fine is not fine at all. Fine is like a mesh sieve, enough space for all the important things to slip through, and all you're left with is to-do lists and resentments. It's easier to be impressive to strangers than it is to be consistently kind behind the scenes. It's easier to show up and be a hit for an hour than it is to get down on the floor with your kids when you're so tired your eyes are screaming and bone dry. It's easier to be charming on a conference call than it is to traverse the distance between you and your spouse, the distance you created. Sometimes being brave is being quiet. Being brave is getting off the drug of performance. For me, being brave is trusting that what my God is asking of me, what my family and community is asking from me, is totally different than what our culture says I should do. Sometimes brave looks boring, and that's totally, absolutely okay. Present over perfect. And now that you don't have to be perfect, you can be good. John Steinbeck. The phrase present over perfect was one I first held tightly to a few Christmases ago. I remember the moment. The table was a train wreck of wrapping paper and unfolded laundry, half-eaten cookies. My mind was running with all the remaining tasks that needed to be done, gifts bought, cards addressed, bags packed, deadlines reached. To put it plainly, my desire for beautiful, sparkly Christmas moments was edging out my ability to live well in my actual life, and I recognized this feeling as one I'd grappled with all my life. I want things to be spectacular, epic, over the top, exciting, and dramatic. But in order to force that beauty and drama into otherwise ordinary moments, you have to push and tap dance and hustle, hustle, hustle. I was faced with a dilemma, one so many of us face quite often. I could either wrestle my life and my kids and my house and our Christmas into something fantastic, something perfect. Or I could plunk myself down right in the middle of the mess and realize that the mess is actually my life, the only one I'll ever get, the one I'm in danger of missing completely, waiting around for fantastic. That Christmas, I chose to be present over perfect, and that's still what I choose today. Some days I do it better than others. It's still a tremendous temptation for me to spin out into achievement or efficiency or performance instead of dwelling deeply in life as it presents itself. In each moment. Indeed, sometimes I can get a little obsessive about pursuing non-perfection just perfectly. But the endeavor itself is transformative. My marriage, my parenting, my friendships, and my connection to God have all been enriched in countless ways along this journey. This isn't about working less or more necessarily. This isn't about homemade or takeout or full-time or part-time or the specific ways we choose to live out our days. It's about rejecting the myth that every day is a new opportunity to prove our worth, and about the truth that our worth is inherent, given by God, not earned by our hustling. It's about learning to show up and let ourselves be seen just as we are, massively imperfect and weak and wild and flawed in a thousand ways, but still worth loving. It's about realizing that what makes our lives meaningful is not what we accomplish, but how deeply and honestly we connect with the people in our lives, how wholly we give ourselves to the making of a better world through kindness and courage. Let's talk for a minute about perfect. Perfect has become as near a dirty word to me as hustle, prove, earn, compete, and push. Perfect is brittle and unyielding, plastic, distant, more image than flesh. Perfect calls to mind stiffness, silicone, and aggressive and unimaginative relentlessness. Perfect and the hunt for it will ruin our lives. That's for certain. The ache for perfection keeps us isolated and exhausted. We keep people at arm's length, if that, and we keep hustling, trying to reach some sort of ideal that never comes. I've missed so much of my actual, human, beautiful, not beautiful life trying to force things into perfect. But these days, I'm coming to see that perfect is safe, controlled, managed. I'm finding myself drawn to mess, to darkness, to things that are loved to the point of shabbiness, or just wildly imperfect in their own gorgeous way. I'm drawn to music that's more earnest than tidy, art that's more ragged than orderly. People who are just a touch more honest than is strictly appropriate for the situation. I'm finished hustling for perfect. It didn't deliver what they told me it would. And so instead, present. If perfect is plastic, present is rich, loamy soil. It's fresh bread, lumpy and warm. It's real and tactile and something you can hold with both hands. Something rich and warm. Present is a face bare of makeup, a sweater you've loved for a decade, a mug that reminds you of who you used to be. It's the Bible with the battered cover, the journal filled with scribbled secret dreams. It isn't pretty, necessarily. It isn't supposed to be. Present is living with your feet firmly grounded in reality, pale and uncertain as it may seem. Present is choosing to believe that your own life is worth investing deeply in. Instead of waiting for some rare miracle or fairy tale, present means that we understand that the here and now is sacred, sacramental, threaded through with divinity, even in its plainness, especially in its plainness. Present over perfect living is real over image, connecting over comparing, meaning over mania, depth over artifice. present over perfect living is the risky and revolutionary belief that the world God created is beautiful and valuable on its own terms and doesn't need to be zhuzhed up and fancy in order to be wonderful. Sink deeply into the world as it stands. Breathe in the smell of rain and the scuff of leaves as they scrape across driveways on windy nights. This is where life is, not in some imaginary photoshopped dreamland. Here, now, you, just as you are, me, just as I am, this world, just as it is, this is the good stuff. This is the best stuff there is. Perfect has nothing on truly, completely, wide-eyed, open-souled present. When I was slipping out of my heels and pencil skirts, my armor for a frantic professional world, in search of a cozier, plainer, simpler way of living, I bought a pair of white Converse All-Stars. Practically speaking, I needed a pair of shoes to wear to a camp. And I needed desperately to go to a camp, to reconnect with nature and silence and water and people who knew me well. The Chucks then became a symbol of the transition from one season to another. They've become the shoes I wear when I want to feel truly grounded. Low-key, low-drama, my plain old self. They're like the jeans you've had forever, the college sweatshirt you can't throw away, the baseball cap that outlasted the boyfriend and has now become part of your own story, part of who you are. When I see them in my closet, I remember that I want to live both feet firmly planted on this gorgeous green earth, that I want to be right here and right now, that I'm loved and known, and that I don't have to hustle or perform. I know that's a lot to get from a pair of sneakers. But sometimes when we're in seasons of great transition, we cling to a couple things very tightly, physical reminders of deep inner revolutions. And I've held tightly to these white Chucks. They're not my first pair. Didn't everyone my age have a pair or two in high school or college? I certainly did along the way. Green ones, black ones, red ones. So these feel familiar, like a return to an essential self, like I'm traveling back to reclaim something, which is exactly what I'm doing. In many ways, I'm retracing the steps I've taken across the last several years to find the woman I used to be. She's definitely nowhere near perfect, but I like her better, and I'm determined to find her again. Part 4, Walking on Water. I have only one thing to do, and that's be the wave that I am, and then sink back into the ocean. Fiona Apple. Walking on Water. Here's the thing about filters. They color everything. Nothing is neutral. Nothing escapes them. The shame glasses I wear almost all the time mean that every story looks like shame to me. Every punchline, every plot twist, they're all the same. You're not good enough. What I'm discovering, though, is that when I take off the glasses, the stories I've been hearing all my life are completely different than I thought, especially stories from the Bible. At a gathering of the practice this summer, Father Michael, a Jesuit priest and Aaron's spiritual director, led us through an Ignatian prayer of imagination. Essentially, he reads a section of scripture aloud and invites us to imagine ourselves in the story. What did it smell like? What did it sound like? What character in the story are you? He used the story of Peter walking on water, deeply familiar for anyone who's grown up in church. I knew this story, of course. I knew that Jesus invited Peter out onto the water. I knew that Peter began to sink and that Jesus scolded him for his lack of faith. I knew that story backward and forward, meaning that I knew the actual story. And I knew in such a visceral, familiar way all the times that I'd been Peter. Step out, sink, receive the scolding. Step out, longer this time. Great job, you're doing it. But then inevitably sink, receive the scolding. The scolding's the worst part, of course. I should be used to it, but it stings every time. I know, I'll try harder. I'll focus more, I promise. And then this gentle priest read the story again and again and again. We listened, exhaled, found ourselves in the story, practiced the prayer of imagination again and again. And there in my chair on a summer Sunday evening, I realized that all my life I'd had the story wrong. I'd twisted it for my own purposes, a practice as old as the hills. We twist the sacred words to tell our own stories. We do it with scripture. We do it in conversation. Whatever you're looking for, you'll find. If you're looking for stories to affirm your deep belief in the goodness of humanity, you'll find them. If you're only seeking stories that say the world is nothing but evil, you'll find them. And if every story you hear, every song you sing, every tale you tell is really a story about shame and about not being good enough, you'll find it. I know this because I've been doing it for years. For me, when someone says, I can't come to your house, I hear, you're not good enough. When someone says, that woman over there is so pretty, I hear, you're not good enough. When someone opens his or her mouth to say almost anything at all, what I hear is you're not good enough. So, of course, that's the story I see in this one. But on that Sunday night, something clicked and released. Before Jesus scolds Peter, first he rescues him. I've had that wrong all my life. I always picture the falter, the failure, the scolding. Then finally, the begrudging hand of help. I knew you couldn't do it yourself. Do I have to do everything? But now I see something entirely new. The rescue came first. When Peter faltered, Jesus reached out a hand before saying a word. What an extraordinary thing. For a girl who's been failing and faltering all her life, bracing myself for the scolding, enduring the disappointment, and gritting my teeth till the hand is finally extended and I'm safe, the rescue coming first changes everything. And this is what really undid me. It's not a scolding at all. It's a loving post-game analysis. Hey, pal, what happened out there? How can we together help you stand? It's so loving, so parental, so protective. Why haven't I ever seen it this way? Because I'm trained for shame and I see it everywhere, even when there's not a shred to be found. But here's the thing. What if it's not there? And what if shame actually isn't in many of the places I think it is? What if all my life I've been trying to walk with a Jesus who reprimands me while I'm drowning and grabs me at the last second, rolling his eyes? No wonder I don't tell him when I'm scared or fragile. Why would I? No wonder most of my prayers sound like minutes at a board meeting, an underling giving the quarterly report. I'm working on this, also this. We'll do better next time on this. So sorry about this again. I'm on it. Since that Sunday, sometimes when I pray, I think about the rescue. And then I think about the tenderness of that conversation after the rescue. I remind myself that I'm building a new set of stories, the ones that were true all along, instead of my old set, whispering shame at every plot point. I think of swimming with our boys and how when one of them struggles, I don't lecture. I don't let them flounder an extra few seconds while I correct them sternly. I scoop them up 100 times an hour if necessary. I watch them, grab them, keep them close. When we're safe again, when we're close to shore, then we talk about deep water or clearing our ears when we dive down deep. But before all that, rescue, rescue, rescue. Even the word moves me. And then the question, why did you doubt? Not what's wrong with you. Not the frustrated and rhetorical, why on earth did you do that? That a parent asks a child after he knocks something off a counter. But a question, an invitation into conversation, a way of saying, I'm here and I care and let's solve this together. I haven't often prayed to a God who says, we've got this. We'll do it together. Your failure doesn't rattle me. Your limitations don't bother me. But I do now, little by little, because now when I step out of that boat, I'm starting to see a man with love in his eyes, a man who will rescue and rescue and rescue and then bring me to safety, despite my faithlessness, despite my failure. This makes me wonder, of course, about all of Scripture. How many other stories have I twisted to tell my own story? How many images of God have I constructed out of my own wounds? And what would happen if I stepped inside of them, like I did this one, and found the narrative fundamentally altered? Thank God for that gentle priest, for a tribe that gathers on Sunday nights, for the ancient tradition of the prayer of imagination. Sometimes we read the same passages all our lives without realizing we've rewritten them in our own images. How much more beautiful is our God when we free him from our own wounds and tired narratives. Tonight, as I fall asleep, I'll picture myself walking on water, and then I'll picture myself being rescued. Baptism. There's a new trend in books, what they're calling burn-it-down stories. Stories about women who hike 1,000 miles or move to the other side of the world or start something crazy or risky or bold. This is my burn-it-down story, essentially. What I'm burning down are the expectations I've long held for who I had to be, what people needed me to be, and the distance those expectations created between God and me, between the people I love and me, and between the beauty of the world and me. A million years ago, or 20 really, I bought a card at the little hippie gift shop in my college town. I glued it to the front of a notebook and scribbled in every direction, every inch of those pages. And this is what that black and white card said from the Japanese mystic Masahide. Barns burned down. Now I can see the moon. When I was 18, 19, 20, I was a mystic, a little bit of a hippie, a voracious reader, a lover of the water and the sky. And now I'm inches from 40, a mother and writer, and the more I peel the onion, the layers of selves and identities, the more surprised I am to find that the self I want to take into my future is more like the 19-year-old than the person I've slipped into, the identities I tried on in more recent years. I feel a longing to be outside, one I haven't felt for years, but one that feels familiar. For many years, there were so many structures that mattered so much to me. Churches and colleges, publishing houses and gyms and malls. But now I find my heart is drawn so entirely to only two places, the table and the water. Our home and the edge of the big water, the two most sacred places I've ever known. One way to look at it, communion and baptism. I'm a table person, a bread and wine person. And I'm a water person profoundly. All my life, I've felt most deeply myself around the table and on the shore, the bread and the wine and the water. We went to a friend's church yesterday, and they were baptizing a baby girl named Anna and a little boy named Knowles. In the children's gathering concurrent with the service, the teacher, Debbie, taught the children about baptism, showing them the water, the shell the priest uses to scoop it, the way the water falls gently onto a doll's head. She explained each part of it, and then she invited each child to practice on the doll with the shell, bowl, water, towel. It was so sweet and beautiful, and now as I sit watching this water so deeply connected to my own past, I can't stop thinking how the water washes us, makes us clean, brings new life, quenches our thirst. When I think about my life now, I think about Pigpen from Peanuts and how as Charles Schulz drew him, he was always surrounded by a cloud of dirt and swirling dust. I think that's how I've lived for a long time without knowing it. I thought that the noise and the chaos and the busyness were somehow always finding me, but I couldn't figure out how. What are the chances? I thought, isn't this funny? But over time, I started to realize that I'm like one of those girls who can't figure out why the drama always finds her. She swears up and down that she has nothing to do with it. But then you watch her trash talk one girl and flirt with another girl's boyfriend, and you realize that even if she doesn't see it, the drama is all her. The chaos is all me. As much as I don't want to admit it, I create it, I'm drawn to it, kick it up when things get too quiet, because when I'm quiet, I have to own up to the fact that quiet terrifies me, that all my life, I've been wrapping myself in noise and chaos the way Pigpen is all wrapped up in dust and dirt, and that noise protects me from feeling all the things I don't want to feel. Here I am, though, the only sound, the waves breaking on the shore, and the intermittent rolls of thunder nearer and nearer. Here I am, though, all alone, just words and a dark sky, hours set aside, blank pages. And here's what's crazy. I was so afraid that if I faced the silence, I would find that inside myself there's simply nothing, that I'm hollow like a set of Russian dolls missing the center doll, all shells and no core. Or I thought that what I would find in the silence was weak, crumbling, unable to face life without the swirling blanket of chaos. Instead, around every corner, I'm finding that willingness to be fragile actually makes me strong. In the silence, I found love. I found love and peace and stillness and gratitude. I used to overwork in order to feel important. What I'm learning now is that feeling important to someone else isn't valuable to me the way I thought it was. Feeling connected is very valuable, but feeling helpful to strangers doesn't do it for me anymore. The rain is falling steadily now, the horizon obscured by fog. The sound of the rain is musical, sweet, and the birds are singing. The temperature has dropped quickly and a cool breeze is coming off the water, infused with misty rain. I love that particular chill you get when you're on the water. And I love the smell of the earth right as the rain begins to fall, rich like minerals and soil and growth itself. If green had a smell, it would smell just exactly like that. like the smell in the Midwestern spring and summer just as it begins to rain. And there's no blue anymore, only green and gray as far as I can see. A few hours ago, blue surrounded me on this beautiful peninsula, sky and sea in almost every direction. But now the gray and the green are deep and complete. The wind is getting stronger and stronger. It's been a rainy summer, profoundly so, with many storms right at bedtime. The boys standing on the porch with us in their pajamas, watching the dark rolling clouds, smelling the rain. As I've stripped things out of my life, constant traveling, overworking, compulsive activity, I'm finding that my senses are attuned so much more deeply than they've been in years. Music is reaching me with a depth I can't remember since my adolescence, and poetry and nature, too. I thought that my midlife season would be about pushing into a new future, and it is. I thought it would be about leaving behind expectations and encumbrances of the past. It is. What I didn't know is that it would feel so much like recovering an essential self, not like discovering a new one. Hold close to your essential self. Get to know it the way you get to know everything in the world about someone you're in love with, the way you know your child, their every freckle and preference, and which cry means what. This self, this fragile and strong, creative, flip-flop and ponytail self, she's been here all along. But I left her behind, almost lost her, when I started to believe that constant motion would save me, that outrunning everything would keep me safe. You cannot be a mystic when you're hustling all the time. You can't be a poet when you start to speak in certainties. You can't stay tender and connected when you hurl yourself through life like being shot out of a cannon, your very speed a weapon you wield to keep yourself safe. The natural world is so breathtakingly beautiful. People are so weird and awesome and loving and life-giving. Why then did I try so hard for so long to get away without feeling or living deeply? A friend was visiting with his spiritual director, listing all the ways that life had disappointed him. His marriage wasn't what he wanted. His childhood left him aching for love. His career wasn't soaring the way he'd imagined it could. On and on he went, listing all the disappointments that were his life. And all at once, the usually reserved priest broke in and yelled his name. These are the terms. Now what's the invitation? What an extraordinary idea. There are terms. And there are invitations. Most of us don't live this way. Or at least control freaks like me don't live this way very often. We like to think that we set the terms and we issue the invitations. But maturity, perhaps, is the realization that we are not handing out terms or invitations. To be very honest, my first several brushes with the terms of my own limitations didn't bring me to maturity. They brought me to blame, to anger, fist shaking, sputtering with fear and outrage. But after enough limitations and failures and small deaths, even I began to come around to the invitations, to the idea that our lives are not blank slates, but they're beautiful nonetheless. No, they're beautiful because of that, because they've been created over time in love and sickness and moments of courage and moments of terror. Getting older means we start to look at our own lives and our own selves the same way we love our partners, our children. When I see Aaron, I see the same eyes I've been looking into for more than 15 years, the same mouth that kissed me first in my parents' garage and a million times since then, each one a brick in the foundation of our life together. What do you need to burn down in your life to make space for a new way of living? What commitments, expectations, roles, structures seem immovable until you start to move them and then find that when you do, everything changes? In my case, to a certain extent, I followed the path that made sense, that unfolded naturally. I held everyone together because I always had. Only now I had a husband and two kids to hold together too. I worked and worked and pushed because that's what I knew how to do. And now, instead of hiding in busyness and codependence and pretending that everything's okay, when I live in the silence, it makes me brave. I feel uninsulated, unarmed, and it makes me bold. Because for the first time in a long time, I'm listening to my own voice and desires. I'm articulating my own vision for my life. Addiction to motion, or faking, or busyness, or obsessive eating, or obsessive dieting, or whatever it is for you, builds just a tiny, luscious buffer between you and everything. So words that would hurt you when you're stone sober just don't bother you after a glass or two of wine. or after you've lost 3 more pounds, or as long as chocolate or pizza can keep you company, keeping you safe and distant. But you take away those things and all of a sudden you find many of your relationships very different than you originally believed. You feel everything, everything. It's like wearing glasses for the first time. I was 6 when I got my first tiny pair, and I remember all of a sudden seeing individual blades of grass where previously there was only a bland, cohesive expanse of green. That's how it is when you leave these things behind. Busyness, exhaustion, codependence, compulsive anything. You can see the cracks and brokennesses in your relationships for what they really are. And you realize that you can't move forward the way you have been. That you either have to fix the cracks or let the connection break. Those are the only two honest ways. And so I've been busy doing both. Repairing cracks in some and letting others shatter, which they should have done a long time ago had I not been holding the scraps together. I'm facing myself for the first time in a long time, and I'm beginning to see myself for what I am, right and wrong, strong and fragile, all the things, all in one. Must be nice. Several years ago, I recognized within myself deep jealousy toward a friend. I picked up on it when I realized my constant refrain about her life was, must be nice. When she told me about her schedule or her family or her day, I felt a snarky, itchy feeling bubble up inside me. Must be nice. This is the thing. Her life seemed lighter than mine, easier, more free, more crafted to reflect her own preferences and passions. Mine had gotten away from me in my blind need to be seen as hyper-capable, ultra-dependable, that girl who can handle anything. I'd built a life I could no longer handle. My to-do list drove me like an unkind taskmaster. And in my most ground-down moments, I looked over at my friend's life, and I saw that she was playing. Sheesh. Connecting. Please. Resting. Come on. Asking for help. What a baby. That's how it starts, at least for me, with disdain. A lot of sheeshing. Because if I can discount her, then I don't have to grapple with my own feelings about her life compared to mine. But I've been down this road enough to know how well it can instruct me if I let it. And so I cracked down through the disdain to see what was underneath, and I wasn't surprised at this point to find pure envy. I wanted to rest and play. I wanted to connect and ask for help and sometimes be fragile and sometimes just stop entirely. I wanted to listen to my own body and spirit instead of feeling like I was on a speeding train that left a station a long time ago and wasn't stopping anytime soon. It seems to me like most of us were taught that jealousy is bad, and so when we feel it, we should push it away from ourselves as quickly as possible. Get rid of it fast. But I'm learning that envy can be an extremely useful tool to demonstrate our desires, especially the ones we haven't yet allowed ourselves to feel. And so I committed to learning from my jealousy toward her. I circled it, picked it up, turned it in my hand like a prism. What are you? I asked. What do you have to teach me? When I allowed myself to tiptoe past the disdain, past the envy, what I found was longing. I was longing for a life that felt light, right-sized for my strengths and limitations. This was never about her. This was about me. So I set to work on making my life look more like my longings. And along that path, I found my jealousy dissipating. And one of the ways I know that I've reached a celebration point along this journey, I'm no longer jealous of my friend. Or of any friend who seems to author her life and walk it out at a pace that works for her. Because these days I author my own pace in life, and I celebrate alongside people who do the same. My disdain and jealousy brought me to change my life because I know that sometimes the darkest parts of us can be our teachers in ways that our sweeter qualities never could. What makes you say, must be nice? What longing might your jealousy lead you to? If you're brave enough to listen to it before you push it away. Your mess is mine. I'm going to a friend's party this week, a party for her child, and that means her family will be there. She texted last night to say, you know how my dad is sometimes, right? I feel worried about my dad at the party. I feel embarrassed. I texted back as quickly as I could, fingers tripping. I get it. I get him. I love you. You don't have to worry about this with me, okay? We texted back and forth a little, and then all night I was thinking about the exchange. I've known her, and therefore her family, for more than 2 decades. We've known each other longer than we've known our husbands. We've known each other since before we could drive. But there's something so human about feeling embarrassed, about wanting to hide, about wanting to conceal and control the out-of-control and painful things about our lives and stories and families. Love, though, doesn't allow hiding. Love invites whole selves and whole stories out into the light. Friendship sees into us, into our secrets, into our elaborate games and excuses. Friendship carries all this mess together so that you